what you have to understand with hormones is that hormones exist in feedback loops.
Right.
If you have high testosterone, you engage in high testosterone behaviors that fortify having high testosterone. So it's kind of like a virtuous circle, and it kind of draws you up. Whereas if you don't have an opportunity to behave in a high testosterone way, then you're drawn down. You know, it's like, and this is what happens to men who lose, you know, like you lose a contest, your testosterone drops, you're less likely to engage in contest. Your testosterone keeps dropping and you can very quickly go down the plug hole. And that's like misfortune in general, right? Is that it accrues very quickly and it kind of snowballs.
Hi folks, I have the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Charles Cornish Dale, otherwise known as Roaring Nationalist, who has just produced a book called The Last Men, Liberalism and the Death of Masculinity, which actually dovetails a lot with a lot of my thoughts on the subject. As I'm sure if you're a regular viewer, you're well aware of my opinions of liberalism and my critiques. And Charles picks up on much the same sort of problems and beginning from actually a very similar position because, strangely enough, I didn't read Francis Fukuyama until I stopped being a liberal, which is unusual because normally he's the liberal go-to of the moral justification of why liberalism will bring about the end of history and why this is not only good but inevitable. And actually, you can read his book much less as an open endorsement and more rather a philosophical prediction. And he gets a lot of stick for being wrong.
Yeah.
But he actually makes a very good case in his book about the nature of liberalism, what it actually does. Mm. And through a right-wing reading of this, which you've provided in your book, we are actually, it's revealed to us that there is a really important aspect of human life that is left out by liberalism that he assumed could be picked up by competition in the free market, but is clearly not sufficient. Why did you begin with Fukuyama?
Yeah, Fukuyama's a funny one because, like you say, you know, he's become this sort of straw man. He is liberal hubris incarnate. And I think in many respects, since he wrote the essay and then the book, The End of History, in the intervening decades, because that was 1989 was the essay, and then it was 1991, I think, the book. He has kind of become that parody, and that's often something, you know, that happens to intellectual figures is they become the parody. Slavoj Žižek is the parody of himself that he, you know, used to be kind of put forward. But like Fukuyama, actually, The End of History and The Last Man. So that's what the book is called, And The Last Man. And that's what people forget. I mean, a lot of people don't even read the book. You know, that's they think they know what Fukuyama was saying. Oh, he's saying, you know, liberal democracy, capitalism has finally triumphed over communism and everything's going to be great, sunny uplands forever. No, I mean, no, that isn't what he said. And so the key part is And The Last Man in the title. And that's the final quarter of the book where he actually launches this quite devastating Nietzschean critique. So The Last Man is a figure from Nietzsche, developed most of all, I think, in Thus Spake Zarathustra, where he really kind of talks about the kind of creature that the last man is, what he represents, the kind of triumph of nihilism. He says, actually, look, okay, I mean, you know, liberal democracy is, we've enthroned liberal democracy now, and it's hard to see whether there could be an alternative to liberal democracy that's as functional as liberal democracy and as enduring as liberal democracy. But actually, there are aspects of life that just, and aspects of man's nature in particular, that just can't be satisfied by liberalism. So there are things you can do under liberalism, and you know, you're one of many millions of people in a nation and billions of people on the earth. You're all equal. You all have equal, let's say, intrinsic moral worth, political value. You each vote. You know, you have equal opportunity in the marketplace, let's say, whether or not that's true, but we believe it. But actually, you don't have any higher goals. Liberalism, the triumph of liberalism, secular liberalism, liberal democracy, it draws man's eyes downwards from higher goals to the material. Being a consumer, you know, existing in a democracy, and every 4 years, you know, you put a cross in a box and then that goes in a ballot box, and you've, you know, participated in politics and, you know, made a change or voted for the status quo or whatever. But actually, you know, that is a traducement of man's nature. You look at what man was in the past, you know, he is like a crepuscular figure. And that's what the last man is. It's this kind of crepuscular figure at the end of history who is reduced to a very, very kind of bounded set of behaviours. I mean, I had just been reading Fukuyama again and thinking about Fukuyama. And I was thinking of writing a book, and I was thinking, you know, how do I... I was grappling with the idea that maybe there is something about the nature of the modern world that is fundamentally hostile to particular aspects of masculinity, or even masculinity full stop, you know, like a full expression of masculinity and testosterone, which obviously is you know, the kind of modulates and drives masculinity in so many different ways. So I was thinking, like, you know, how could I frame this? How could I put it? And then I thought, actually, you know what, like, the things that Fukuyama is saying, and he talks in particular about thymos, which is this ancient Greek concept. So, I mean, the ancient Greeks were very, very astute observers of man's nature and his, you know, aims and attributes and traits and psychological aspects and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, they used a different vocabulary to describe it. But thymos is often translated as spiritedness. And it's what kind of drives man to do stuff, to compete, to achieve, to defend his own city-state, the nation, whatever. And Fukuyama talks about the triumph of liberal democracy as the triumph of a particular kind of thymos at the expense of another. So he says, you know, under liberal democracy, isothymia, which is a desire to be, and he calls it desire for recognition is what he calls thymos, but isothymia, which is the desire to be recognized as equal. Well, you know, that's the kind of thymos that is enshrined by liberal democracy. We're all equal, and, you know, we have equal value, and we'll all be respected and recognized as equal. But there's another kind called megalothymia, which is something that is much more prevalent, you know, throughout the rest of history, where actually men compete against one another for a place in a hierarchy, for recognition as better than their peers. And that's one of the things that liberal democracy can't satisfy. So even in Fukuyama, even in the end of history, Fukuyama is saying, like, you know, there's this fundamental aspect of man's nature, desire to be better than his peers, that can't be satisfied. And he makes some quite dismal predictions, actually. You know, he says, actually, liberalism is a kind of iron cage, which is the metaphor that Max Weber used in The Protestant Ethic. You know, like, it really does trap people. And maybe the only way that people are going to be able to find a way to satisfy these megalothymic impulses that they have, men in particular, obviously, is through what Fukuyama calls immense wars of the spirit. And he really literally means wars. He's like, you know, you're going to have to burn everything down and try and start again in order to reassert a different kind of value system and, you know, a hierarchy. But actually what you can do is you can think of, and this is what I do with the framing of the book, is to think of thymos as testosterone, the master male hormone. So that's Fukuyama's framing of the end of history is how I kind of is how I frame the book, really, you know, the argument and about progression of liberalism and thymos in particular. But then I say, look, like, the things that Fukuyama says on the, let's say, like, the political and social level about thymos, you can go a level deeper, and you can talk about biology, and you can talk about changes to biology and constraints that are placed on the expression of biological aspects of man's nature, including his hormones. And that's not actually something that anybody's really ever done. So Fukuyama provides the kind of skeleton and the kind of philosophical grounding for the book, which then goes off into the depths of biology, which is something that makes a lot of people actually quite nervous when you start talking about politics and biology.
It's one of those things that's deeply unpopular.
Yeah.
Because we live in a distinctly anti-essentialist period of time. But I mean, this was inevitable from liberalism itself. This is just more of the conquest of liberalism. Because, I mean, in any other time, place in history, obviously a thing is because of its essential characteristics. Mm. And this is just completely uncontroversial until, well, about right now, incidentally.
Yeah.
But this is a really interesting point because, I mean, my reading of Fukuyama was he optimistically hoped that capitalism would save the megalothymotic impulses from burning the country down. But the thing I think that he was a bit blind to, and liberals generally are blind to, is that the spiritedness and the sort of willingness to defend oneself is also tied up with a kind of group understanding. So Thymos is not an individual aspect of the human soul, actually. It's deeply connected to the group. And the problem that I think Fukuyama, like you said at the beginning, people do down Fukuyama unnecessarily. It's actually a very sophisticated book.
Yeah, it really is.
And I very much appreciated his Hegelian reading of liberalism. I agree with it. I think it's correct that there is this desire for recognition that underpins basically all of political activity. And you see this constantly where they say, you know, we see you, you're seen. What are they giving them there? They're giving them recognition and understanding. And that I think Fukuyama nailed that completely correctly. But I think he was a bit optimistic towards the end of it. It's like, well, hopefully capitalism and competition in the market through business can save the civilization from its own megalothymotic impulses. And I think that we're seeing that's not the case. And
well, what's interesting actually as well is that who does he use as an example? Donald Trump.
That's true.
He actually talks about Donald Trump and because he says, you know, well, what's the future of megalothymia under capitalism? Well, actually, we don't, although I've talked about these, you know, immense wars of the spirit and think it's a real possibility, nevertheless, we don't see at this moment any real desire for revolt. You know, everything seems good and okay, you can be Donald Trump and, you know, you can satisfy to some extent megalothymia through business deals and marrying supermodels and, you know, being really successful and being a billionaire. Well, that's a very interesting, you know, prediction to come back to.
What's so great about that? I forgot that you'd used the example of Donald Trump, actually. What's so great about that is Donald Trump's entry into politics is a direct consequence of the thymotic desire to save America.
Yes, exactly.
It was directly connected to the group he felt he belonged to and the thing that he felt he had stewardship over and had obligations towards. I mean, Donald Trump didn't need to do anything political. He's a wealthy, famous man. What did he need? He was lacking for nothing except the emotional security of knowing he'd done his part. And so this, again, I'm actually quite a respecter of Fukuyama on the fact that his work is actually good, or at least this was good. And he couldn't predict the future.
No.
And it's not his fault.
No.
And really, when you extrapolate from what he's written, honestly, you can see why they would think that at the time. Now, events have conspired to prove it wrong, but that's fine. This is what happens. But I'd like to go back to your biological thoughts there, because this is one of those things where it's, I mean, it feels forbidden, say, but everyone knows that it is true, that there is a biological reality underpinning men and women's interactions, and that this is not static.
No.
Because one of the difficult things that, I mean, sorry, just to go off a bit of a tangent, but the problem with liberalism is that it seeks to actually kind of crystallize all of the world into an ever-present now, where actually there aren't trends and there aren't changes.
No.
And where the biology of a person is not actually determinate of that person. And so all of these heresies go unattended. And I think this is the problem that has been raising its head is what happens to men when essentially testosterone falls off a cliff and they essentially stop being men and we end up looking at the death of masculinity. What does the future look like then? And is this actually happening?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I mean, the philosophical grounding of the book in Fukuyama is meant to say, look, first of all, we've got a political and a social system that is potentially hostile to testosterone and to expression of testosterone-driven behaviours.
Not even potentially.
Yeah, exactly. Not potentially, but, you know, like I'm hedging it a little bit.
I appreciate you've got to, but I'm...
Yeah, no, I mean, we live in a profoundly misandrist society. And, you know, I mean, you need to look at the, you know, latest video of Sabrina Carpenter, you know, getting an enormous crowd to shout useless.
And that's the most trivial expression of it as well.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
For me, I see it in my son's schools because, of course, they're very regular boys growing up. And they are surrounded by women who impose a feminine regime on them.
Well, we're probably the only society in history that has imposed the task of educating boys into men on women.
It's insane, isn't it?
Imagine if you went to an African nation, you know, if you're an anthropologist in the 1960s or whatever, you know, and you'd said, is it a good idea to let women I mean, first of all, you'd have observed that it wasn't women educating the young boys into men. But also, if you'd said that, they'd be like, you know, what Why are you talking about? Yeah. And in fact, I think if you'd travel back to any society in history, that would have been the case.
Well, I mean, go back 100 years. We had segregated education.
Mm. Yeah.
Like this, I mean, Australia still has hundreds of sex-segregated educational facilities just because this is what they inherited from the British Empire. Mm. And it made sense because it worked.
Mm. Yes, exactly. So we live in this, yes, we do live in a profoundly misandrist society, and we live in a political system that I think is geared against the expression of testosterone-driven behaviours. But then, yes, there's this biological problem that's taking place as well. And I mean, that one of the central statistics in the book is that testosterone levels in the developed world are falling 1% year on year and have been for decades. And okay, 1% doesn't sound like much, but 25 years, it's 25%. You know, you could extrapolate the graph and end up at a point where there's no testosterone or like very little. So there's something happening at the biological level as well. And the question is what's driving it? And part of what's driving it, I think, is the fact that we live in a society that isn't geared towards expressions of behavior that are driven by testosterone.
Can we pause on that? Because that sounds like a politically correct way of saying a society that isn't physically confident, right? Because, I mean, I think what we are saying is men are not, and it doesn't have to mean necessarily violence and conflict.
No.
But you can look back at there are videos of like, you know, teenagers at school in the 1960s, and they're doing a lot more physical activity than they do now.
Yes.
By a long way. Like, I remember a video on my time I came across of just all the boys in the school doing some monkey bar thing. And I was like, God, could I even do that?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, it was just normal.
But it was completely normal.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that I think is really what we need to think about is the physicality of life.
Well, I mean, the thing is, and what you have to understand with hormones is that hormones exist in feedback loops.
Right.
And so, you know, if you have high testosterone, you engage in high testosterone behaviors that fortify having high testosterone.
Hmm.
So it's kind of like a virtuous circle, and it kind of draws you up. Whereas if you don't have opportunity to behave in a high testosterone way, then you're drawn down. You know, it's like, and this is what happens to men who lose, you know, like you lose a contest, your testosterone drops, you're less likely to engage in contest, your testosterone keeps dropping, and you can very quickly go down the plug hole. And that's like misfortune in general, right, is that it accrues very quickly and it kind of snowballs. I mean, when you don't give men any kind of satisfying outlet to behave as men, when it's not even, I mean, I remember when I went to primary school, we had a very, very left liberal head teacher, and he instituted these non-competitive sports days. He was real Blair's Britain.
Yeah.
And in fact, actually, it was quite funny, you know, at the Millennium, he wrote this special Millennium song, and we went to 10 Downing Street and sang it outside 10 Downing Street. But what was so funny actually about that was that he knocked on 10 Downing Street. Tony Blair didn't come out. So he was like, yeah, we're going up to see Tony Blair, and he's going to stand on the step and we'll sing to him. And it's like this appalling dirge, you know, that he'd written. But yeah, I mean, like a non-competitive, no one can win or lose.
Mm.
We were just doing activities in a series of kind of like circuits, and then nobody won or lost.
And that's a very, I hate to say this, but feminine position to inhabit.
Yes, it is.
Because I don't know about you, but I've been very competitive my whole life. I, you know, I don't necessarily win every time.
Yeah.
And that's fine. Sometimes you lose. You take it on the chin. But when you win, you want the thrill of winning. And if the other people can't lose, why did I bother?
Mm. Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, it's true. And that's actually a very natural attitude for men. But it is the opposite of the kind of haywire feminine, everyone must be wrapped in cotton wool, everyone must be protected, nobody must ever feel threatened or that they're not as good as someone else, and, you know, consolation prizes for everyone. And that is driving it. But then there's also a kind of chemical problem, which is our exposure to, you know, harmful chemicals. And we happen to have built a civilization on ubiquitous exposure to chemicals that just so happen to mimic estrogen or to drive the production of estrogen in the human body.
Well, this is a massive problem, isn't it? With
enormous
birth control.
Birth control.
In the water and
plastics.
Various micro...
pesticides, herbicides.
I was going to bring up the fact that you've got a chapter that mentions the gay frogs.
Yeah.
Because I remember years ago covering this in a video saying, well, to be honest with you, Alex Jones is underselling it. It's transing the frogs. Yeah. It is turning a lot of them gay, but it's also transing them. And this is one of those things where you don't realize what's in your water. You don't realize what's in your food. And we haven't got any, well, I mean, we probably have the studies now, but like way back in the day, nobody thought twice about it.
No. And this is, you know, I mean, there's a conspiracy theorist's version. I hate using that term because obviously it's a pejorative, but there is a conspiratorial way of approaching this, which is thinking, you know, like, oh, the people in charge, you know, they're putting chemicals in the water deliberately to make us. And no, it's a kink of chemistry. It's a kink of the human body and the way that the human body and animal bodies respond to these chemicals, that they just so happen to drive the production of estrogen, or mimic estrogen, which in many ways it's better actually to think of as a stress hormone rather than the female hormone. Anyway, but yes, I mean, you know, we created these incredibly useful substances and things, plastic, right? I mean, infinitely malleable. You can make anything, any kind of shape you want out of plastic. You can make a dashboard, you can make an iPhone case. You
know, it's incredible.
You can make a handgun, you know, whatever. And so in our rush to embrace these new technologies, we didn't do adequate safety testing. And we didn't understand. I mean, there were people warning in the 1950s about herbicides and pesticides. There's a book called Silent Spring that was written in the 1950s. I think it's Rachel Carson, which was about DDT. It was 63, maybe it was, and it something like that. And it led to the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency in the US under Nixon. Because, you know, this woman said DDT is seriously bad. We're creating a toxic environment. And also that the chemical companies the manufacturers were covering up in kind of in collusion with the government as well. So there is kind of a conspiratorial element, but you can see that there are incentives like profit in particular that drive inattention to the negative side effects.
This is the thing that is the problem with conspiratorial thinking. And I'm not saying that I'm not subject to it like anyone else, but when you actually break it down, it does seem to just be a system of incentives.
Yes,
about profit motives.
Yeah, and that's a powerful enough argument to explain it. It's like, look, like the pesticide man, the people who make glyphosate, they make billions and billions of dollars a year. I mean, like, of course they're going to want to, of course they're going to suppress evidence that it's harmful. Yeah. Of course they're going to promote it. Of course they're going to have lobbyists on Capitol Hill. You don't need to think that the guy who founded Monsanto is, you know, like Darth Vader or the Emperor Palpatine or some, you know, evil dark lord. You know, he's just a guy who wants to make money. And they hit on a chemical that makes money, but also has terrible effects on the environment and animals and humans.
And the scope of the system means that it turns very, very slowly.
Yes.
So all of this has come to light, well, how do you get the thing changed? Mm. Well, it's a very long and complex series of mechanisms.
Yeah, because you have all of these entrenched interests. And I mean, the other thing as well is the nature of science and the nature of testing. Once you get outside a laboratory, causation is much harder to establish and it's much easier to dispute. If you're doing... like the gay frogs experiments, for example, that were done by Tyrone Hayes in around about 2010, which Alex Jones referenced. I mean, he was talking about like real science, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But because it was Alex Jones, he was ridiculed. In a laboratory setting, you know, you isolate the frogs, you put them in a beaker or whatever with atrazine, this herbicide, and reliably male larvae turn into female frogs and they can mate with, and they're actually fertile and can mate with male frogs. When you get outside the laboratory and you're talking about atrazine in a river, it's very, very difficult to isolate all of the variables. And it's all causation is muddied. And you can say, well, did you, you know, there are other chemicals in the water as well, other than atrazine. Is it those chemicals that are doing it? And so it becomes much harder to identify causation and to say for sure, oh, it's the atrazine that's doing it. And that works as well to the advantage of the chemical manufacturers, you know, that like they can fund their own studies and they can have scientists who dispute. And, you know, that's just how it works. Like, it's a complex world and science is complex. And yes, you have these vested interests. I mean, science is not a neutral institution. No. It just isn't. Science isn't a neutral practice, you know. I mean, and you see this with processed food and you know, like, I mean, they have... I mean, processed food manufacturers, not only do they pay scientists, you know, they're paying influencers to tell, you know, like the people who make Novo Nordisk and these companies that make weight loss jabs, you know, they're paying fat positivity influencers to tell you that there's no way you can lose weight other than, it doesn't matter if you have another bowl of cereal, it doesn't matter if you go on a diet or, you know, start exercising, you can't lose the weight. Mm. So use the pill, use the jab. So it's a complex business. I mean, occasionally you will find evidence of companies, and I talk about this in the book in the Gay Frogs chapter, where I address head on, you know, the conspiracy about putting chemicals in the water deliberately. You will find examples of companies like, for instance, DuPont and 3M deliberately suppressing safety data from the regulators because they know.
Yeah.
So these PFAS chemicals, per and polyfluoroalkyl substances, they're used as non-stick coatings and fire retardants and that kind of stuff. 3M and DuPont in the 1950s and 60s knew that they were seriously, seriously toxic and associated with birth defects and cancers, and if you inhaled them, you could die and all this kind of stuff. And they deliberately suppressed the data for five decades. So there was, like, you know, workers at a DuPont factory, were the women would give birth to children with birth defects at a massively elevated rate.
Right.
But they were saying things like, it's no more toxic than table sugar and stuff like that, right? Then there were cases, and it was brought out that they'd done all this internal testing and just hidden the data. So they're in, you know, paying out hundreds of billions of dollars now. And I would imagine that does go on. That's not an isolated case. It's one thing to start with, like, a master plan. You know, that just isn't how it works.
Well, also, I can't help but feel that conspiracizing—that's a word—on I'm coining it on this subject is actually a kind of cope.
Mm.
And it's not that these things aren't happening; they are happening.
Yeah.
But when you portray the villain, the CEO of a company as a villain.
Mm.
What you're saying is, I'm important enough to them for them to have designs on me.
Sure, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And actually, that's not the case.
No.
Actually, it's a very callous, inhuman machine that they end up running in.
Yeah.
And they are literally just making cost benefits analysis. Mm. And to them, you are just numbers on a spreadsheet.
Mm.
You aren't a person that needs to be defeated. Mm. You aren't important.
And in many respects, actually, they're not to excuse their behavior, but their behavior is actually constrained by the system as well.
Correct.
It's not just that you're constrained by the system to drink water that has harmful chemicals in it. It's also that, like, as CEO of Bayer or Monsanto or 3M or DuPont, whatever, like, the CEO is constrained too.
Yeah.
It's like you can't go into a board meeting and say, well, right, PFAS is harmful. We're never going to sell PFAS again. Like,
he literally won't have the power to do that, even if he wanted to. But this is exactly the problem, where they're so removed from the people that they are supposed, that they are having an effect on.
Yeah,
that you are, like, we've got to understand there isn't an intentionality here. This is just a product of a system that is working as a machine.
Mm.
And so we've got to get past that, I think. But the thing about all of this, okay, so we're polluting the world around us in ways that aren't obviously bad, right? Mm. So I mean, it sounds bad the way we're framing it. But like you said, if they're pumping this chemical into the water, it might only be a small amount of the chemical.
Mm.
So it might take 20 years to see the effect. So in the immediate scope of time, well, there doesn't seem to be any problem. So what are you complaining about? It's like, well, exactly, right? And then, oh, we're far down the line and now we've got all of these problems that are very difficult to reverse engineer because we're so committed to all these things. this is a massive issue that I think that we've had with science generally. We've got lots of examples of this.
Yeah.
But the issue that we have, is it possible that it becomes unrecoverable at some point? As in, because people are not comfortable with addressing the fact that biology is not static, and it does inform the layers of society and civilization that are built upon it. If we end up with a society full of soy boys, and we can see that we've got quite a few of them anyway, they're not inclined to want to try and recapture the masculinity that's denied to them.
No, quite. So, yeah. So this is, I mean, this is the interesting thing. So, yes, I mean, it is.
So do we find ourselves falling into a trap that is essentially irreversible?
Potentially. And I mean, the biological trends are very bad. So I've talked about testosterone declining 1% year on year. That's actually part of a much broader decline in fertility, as you'd expect. You know, like if a man's testicles aren't producing testosterone, the Leydig cells aren't producing testosterone, they're probably not going to be producing sperm as well. And that's exactly what we're seeing. So there's this prediction that's often called Spermageddon that I talk about.
I've heard about it.
Yeah. And it's been made by various people, but it's been most popularized by this woman called Shanna Swan, Professor Shanna Swan, who's one of the foremost experts in reproductive health at Mount Sinai University in New York. She wrote a book in 2021 or two called Countdown about sperm count decline and fertility decline. She's been on Joe Rogan, you know, she's a mainstream figure. She has done loads of work on sperm counts since the 1990s, and the trends all point in one direction. You extrapolate the line, by 2045, by 2050, the median man, so that's the man right in the middle, has a sperm count of zero. And what that means is one half of all men, no sperm at all. The other half, so few that it doesn't matter, because you have to have a certain amount of sperm, even to have a chance of fertilizing an egg. You know, it's a numbers game. It really is. So in one very immediate way that has all sorts of political ramifications, this kind of crisis of biology could actually mean that natural reproduction is impossible within a generation in Western countries and maybe in the developing world as well. And, you know, politically, that's important in all sorts of different ways. I mean, birth rates have been declining in the West for a long time, and it's been attributed to prosperity, for example. And yeah, because I mean, the Roman Empire, similar things happened. You know, you build this prosperous society, and people don't want to have children in the same way maybe that they did.
But notice the point there, they don't want to. So it is at least a choice.
Yes.
It's an option.
Exactly.
But that's actually coming off the table now.
Yes, yeah. So there are obviously social and economic reasons why people don't have or are having fewer children. And you know, I mean, parenthood is disparaged in so many different ways, especially for women.
Don't get me started.
Yeah.
I talk about this a lot. Because, I mean, you're roughly the same age as me, right?
I am 38.
You're 38. I'm 46. When I was a kid, McDonald's was a children's restaurant.
Sure. Yeah. Right?
Every McDonald's had a big play area.
Family restaurant.
It was a family restaurant, and it was very colourful. And you look at the grey post-apocalyptic monolith blocks.
There's no ball pool anymore.
Why would you take your kids to this? Because it's obviously designed to just get you in and out as quickly as possible. But all of civilization was literally geared around everyone's going to have kids, so you need something for the kids to do. Well, it's the opposite now. And so no wonder parenthood is such a maligned institution, despite the fact that it's so vital to the existence of the civilization itself.
Well, exactly. But, you know, so you've got these kind of social and economic incentives, and you've got pop culture and people kind of constantly hammering this message, don't have children, climate change agenda, all that kind of stuff. It's immoral, blah, blah, blah. But then you've also actually got a biological problem that is driving down birth rates as well. And, I mean, the stock response to falling birth rates in the West has been to import people.
Yeah.
For decades and decades and decades, and Western nations import their positive birth rates. That's just the default way you do it. And the only nation really in the West that has challenged that is Hungary under Orban. Well,
but even then, have they actually managed to bring it back?
No. Well, this is the thing. Yeah, this is the thing that I talk about in the book, is that, you know, actually, Orban brought in his flagship measures, I think in 2017 was the kind of first round of tax breaks for young people who get married and have children, and interest-free loans, and there was the headline-grabbing policy, a woman who has four children never pays tax again, you know, and you think, oh, that's going to drive the birth rate up. Well, guess what? It didn't. I mean, there's been a modest increase that actually is probably attributable to recovery from the 2008 financial crisis, they reckon. Really? So if you look at the Balkans and Central Europe, Eastern Europe, were badly, that kind of region, badly hit by the 2008 financial crisis. And you can look at neighbouring countries and you see that actually, that obviously don't have the Orbán tax measures, they see a little modest bounce as well. And so it looks like actually, you know, it's like we're returning kind of to normality and the economic hardship has eased off a little bit. Yeah. So it's not clear that you can, in a very easy way, in a way that would be satisfying to genuine right-wingers, which is, you know, encouraging actual natives of the country to have children, it's not actually obvious that you can just do that easily. You certainly can't just throw money at people. I mean, on Twitter, you know, then there, I'm sure you saw this, there was a post about a study that showed that if you give money to men, the birth rate increases, and if you give money to women, the birth rate decreases, which may be getting somewhere closer to the problem of redistribution in order to encourage your birth rate. But there is also this biological thing that is happening where, like, sperm counts are declining, and it's also having an effect on women as well. So, I mean, there was a study from Singapore that I talk about in the book that shows that women with higher levels of PFAS chemicals in their body
You're going to have to explain what those are to me.
So PFAS, I mentioned a little bit earlier, they're fire retardants. They're used in plastics to make plastics bendy. And they're non-stick coatings as well. It's one of the reasons you shouldn't have a Teflon pan.
Teflon, I cook with Teflon all the time.
Do you? Well, I'm sure you do things to mitigate, you know.
No, I don't do anything to mitigate anything. What are you talking about? What do I need to do? I didn't know it was poisonous.
Get a stainless steel or a copper pan or a ceramic pan.
Oh, God.
But women who have the highest levels of PFAS chemicals in their body are 40% less likely to bring a live child to full term. So it's affecting women seriously as well as men. It's the sperm count decline is the headline grabbing thing that's seized upon. But actually, it's as bad for women as well. So it's just this horrible problem that's you know, like, neither sex is insulated from it. And nobody really knows what to do about it.
Well, you know what? That's interesting, because I recall a few years ago, didn't the Danish government basically propagandize their own citizens to have children?
I think so,
And as I recall, it increased the birth rate by 5%. But it was a big campaign, and it sounded, don't get me wrong, 5% is better than minus 5%. But it was clear that wasn't going to be sufficient to persuade people to have children at a sustainable rate.
And I mean, I think that there's I've spoken at the natalism conference.
I was there.
Yeah, you were. You were.
I spoke there too.
You know, when I spoke there, then I spoke about this passage from, so I was supposed to be like a controversialist, you know. That's what I was billed as, someone who'd present a controversial perspective. And so, you know, because you've got a lot of like data people there who are like, well, you know, you give incentives and you let people have homes and, you know, they're more likely to have children, which may or may not be true. But I kind of came from a kind of left field, and I talked about this passage from Bronze Age Mindset, where famous, you know, one of the most famous bits from that, where he talks about a chimp in state of nature never jerks off, right? And it seems like it's very funny, and you're like, oh it's funny, haha. But actually, like, it's a profound point, because what it gets at is this question of whether we are like chimpanzees in a zoo or like animals in captivity, you know, because we know well enough that kind of higher animals in captivity, not just chimpanzees, pandas, tigers, big cats, you know, they're not happy. And they don't one of the things they don't do is reproduce. You see all the massive effort that zookeepers go to get two pandas to mate, right? And maybe what that means is that, you know, when an animal, when a complex animal is in an environment in which it can't actually exert its true nature, when it can't be what it really is, you know, like you can have an enclosure full of tigers and throw them big pieces of meat. Like, that's not really what they want to do. They'll eat it and they'll lay around, they'll clean themselves, but they're not, that isn't what a tiger really wants to do. Not necessarily has a like a detailed conception of what it should do, but it is
going back to the virtuous spiral, right? The reinforcing, the tiger hunts, yes. And after successfully hunting, it then is like, right now I need to mate, and it's this like reinforcing.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe there's something of that to the problem of reproduction in the modern world. You know, like maybe the modern world is a prison. Maybe the modern world is a zoo, and we're stuck in this zoo, and we're not actually really, which comes back to the Fukuyama stuff. Yeah. You know, it's like maybe we're not actually fulfilling our nature, and maybe somehow that just saps us of our vitality and of our will to perpetuate the species. I mean, it's kind of it's impressionistic language, and it's quite difficult to talk about, because it's not actually something that many people kind of really address. And what you're actually ending up doing is you're ending up with like a metaphysical conception of man, which is you know, people are absolutely allergic to now. It's like, you know, you're a set of genes that want to reproduce themselves. Well, or whatever, or, you know, you're just like an economically minded individual. It's like, no, you're not. I mean, like there is something that isn't how man has existed for the entire span of his history until 100 years ago.
And what's more is, I'm not even sure I think zoo is the correct term, because zoos imply kind of zookeepers who are not affected by the cage.
Yeah.
I think we've kind of self-domesticated in a way.
Sure.
Where we've willingly walked into this because it seemed to make rational sense to do so. Mm. If I'm a resource-gathering creature, well, having the resources on tap with very little effort of my own, well, that makes perfect rational sense. Yeah. Yes, it does.
Yeah.
And 100 years down the line, we're getting to the point where however many percent of men now just can't reproduce because their testosterone is too low. I mean, famously, the BuzzFeed experiment from a few years ago.
That was
where they had
funny.
Lower testosterone than the average sort of 80-year-old or something like this.
Yeah, or a banana.
It's just like, right, okay, well, so, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that, okay, well, that's the position we found ourselves in. So does it make rational sense to continue on like this? Mm. And the answer is no, but the problem is to say, well, okay, what would we need to undo to go back to these sorts of things? And it seems ridiculous to ask us to undo the comfort we have created for ourselves.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to abandon the comfort.
Well, systems are self-perpetuating.
Yeah.
I mean, a system, a properly functioning system, is self-preserving. And whether you're talking about a biological system or a social system, you know, they have all sorts of mechanisms to ensure their perpetuation. And it's unusual for a very, very complex system to collapse, a complex social system. Like the collapse of communism was spectacular, right? But it took a long time. And it, you know, the communists, the people in charge, you know, they fought very hard to uphold it in accordance with, like, you know, the incentives and the nature of the system itself. So, but I mean, what's interesting, I think, is that testosterone, I mean, one of the arguments that I make in the book is that actually, you know, like testosterone drives particular kinds of political behavior, it drives particular kinds of belief as well. So this is a controversial subject, and this is something that actually, you know, there isn't as much research as I'd like there to be, but there is enough research actually to say some quite interesting things. So there's this whole species of like social psychological experiment that goes on, where groups of men are either given a testosterone gel or a placebo.
I've seen these, yeah.
So they rub it on your arm and it gives you a testosterone boost or nothing, right? And then what they do is they assess the effects of this testosterone boost on particular kinds of behavior or attitudes. And what do you find? Well, you find, for example, that men who are given a testosterone boost are happier with inequality and hierarchy, right? And that's actually quite profound, because at a basic level, the difference between left and right turns on the attitude towards hierarchy.
It becomes a biological question. Mm.
But leftists want to level hierarchy in all forms. They're constantly discovering new forms of hierarchy and trying to flatten them. And what does a right-winger or conservative want to do? Preserve the correct forms of hierarchy so that society functions as it should with everything in its proper place.
Mm.
So at once then you're actually asking, well, okay, if we're seeing a decline in testosterone, is that reinforcing particular kinds of harmful political behaviour? And it's obviously the case that the left is against testosterone and against traditional forms of masculinity. And so are
explicitly
we... Explicitly. And I talk in the book about the 2024 election, which was very, very funny because for the first time, really, in American politics, or maybe even in kind of politics in general, then testosterone actually became an explicit dividing line. So, you know, when the Tucker Carlson documentary that I was in 2022, The End of Men, came out, it was absolutely ridiculed by the leftist media, right?
Yeah.
By people like George Takei and...
Unfairly. And
Colbert.
Completely unfairly.
Yeah, but they were like, look, this is nonsense. Like, the notion that... Firstly, the notion that there is a testosterone decline and sperm count decline is nonsense. That's a conspiracy theory. But then also, why would that matter? You know, like, it has no political implications whatsoever. Fast forward 2 years, and you've got the DNC, Planned Parenthood, come along with a mobile clinic, a mobile vasectomy clinic. So you can go as a man to the Democrat National Convention, get the snip, be emasculated, and then go in the hall and like...
Vote for the Democrats.
Yeah, vote. Yeah. Like, it's so on the nose, but that was real. That actually happened. And then what you also had in the hall was you had commentators, it was Dana Bash at CNN saying, look, this came after the RNC as well. So like the RNC was insane. You know, Trump had been shot in the ear a week before.
Yeah.
You've got Hulk Hogan on stage, ripping his top off, let Trumpomania run. I mean, it's like Madison Square Garden in 1983, you know, WrestleMania 1 or whatever. Just insane kind of 1980s energy, you know, like testosterone. Mm. Like, you've got this hero candidate who has, you know, triumphed over adversity and death to be there. And then the DNC, you have these people like Dana Bash, and they're like, look, we're not that party. We're not the party of Hulk Hogan and men who want to drink beer and shoot guns and have big muscles. We're the party of the non-traditional man who isn't governed by his testosterone. Oh. And in actual fact, having less testosterone is more likely to make you vote for our candidate, a female, you know, person of color, with a white man taking the back seat as vice president, you know. So we actually need masculine decline, testosterone decline, to drive progress. That's the only way that you're likely to get men who would otherwise be pigheaded and not want to vote for a female candidate to do the opposite. And that was explicitly laid out, but really for the first time.
And what is so funny about this is that white women voted Republican.
Yeah.
56% of white women voted for Trump.
Mm.
So the white women said, no, I choose testosterone.
It was very, very clear. I mean, I think the dividing line was more along race, you know.
Obviously. Oh, yeah, absolutely. This is why a lot of online commentators go, oh, it's women that are the problem. It's like, no, the majority of women voted for Trump in America. The white women voted for Trump. Like, a lot of it, you're exactly right. I think it was ethnic self-interest that actually dominated. Because, of course, the Democrats being the party of redistribution, they were just voting in their own personal self-interest. Mm. But, and also, and this is another thing, I've had lots of experience, like, with ethnic minorities who have said to me, I actually quite like Donald Trump.
Yeah.
They respect his attitude. Mm. He's doing the best for his people.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course you understand that. Mm. You know, and you would do the same if you were in his shoes, you know? And it's not that they're going to vote for Donald Trump.
No.
But they respect that they know and understand what he is.
Yeah.
Whereas with the Democrats, they despise them and they just understand this is a way of receiving.
Yeah.
You know, it's patronage. So one thing I wanted to get onto was the consequences on a sort of physical level of the lack of testosterone.
Yes.
Right, because this is something that everyone knows that a man with low testosterone is going to be less strong, less aggressive, vote Democrat. But it's actually got health implications as well, doesn't it?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, low testosterone is tied to all sorts of conditions. I mean, One of the things I try to challenge in the book, actually, is this kind of pop science view that testosterone is just the aggression hormone.
Yeah.
So, you know, because you'll get this kind of these kind of pop science arguments. Well, actually, okay, if testosterone is declining, that's a good thing because we don't really want an aggressive civilization. And
so,
I mean, I'm sorry, I didn't agree to this. Exactly. And I mean, there's some interesting science, some like long-term science of testosterone decline that I briefly touch on in the book about whether there's actually been a long-term testosterone decline since the period when our ancestors were hunter-gatherers. Mm. And if you look at skeletal evidence from like 50,000 years ago, hunter-gatherer skeletons, and then consider, you know, like skeletons of early agriculturalists and all that, you see a progressive reduction in skeletal features associated with high testosterone, so like massive brow ridges and prominent cheeks,
thick
and
jaws,
big head, you know. And so there's this argument that maybe actually, you know, like the move from small bands of hunter-gatherers, like let's say 100 people max, 150, to the first complex urban civilizations may have necessitated some kind of decline in testosterone to facilitate cooperation. Mm. It's speculative. It's, you know, there's no, you can't measure an ancient hunter-gatherer's testosterone. Sure. You can look at his skull.
But it seems to stand to reason that if you have a very high-pressure physical existence hunting mammoths or whatever, then, it's going to select for those sorts of men who are more aggressive. Whereas if you're a farmer, it's going to select slightly against.
Yeah, for cooperation in different ways and like, even just living in close proximity with large numbers of people, you know, like the first agricultural cities in the Near East, you know, they had as many as 50,000 people in them. You go from 100 people to 50,000. I mean, that's going to necessitate quite significant changes in the way that people behave. And I mean, my general contention would be that different kinds of societies are different hormonal environments as well as social environments, they're hormonal environments. But the view that testosterone is just an aggression hormone is wrong. It's totally wrong. That isn't the only thing that it governs. It is involved in aggression, but estrogen is also involved in aggression. So I talk about some of the evidence for estrogen being involved in aggression. But testosterone actually governs so many aspects of being a man. It's not just responsible for muscle mass and strength or aggression, thrustingness, that kind of stuff. You know, it governs motivation. I mean, men with low testosterone.
Happiness.
Men with low testosterone are likely to be depressed. Men with lower testosterone are more likely to have less of a sense of agency. This is something that I have tweeted about, you know, like you're less likely to feel like you are kind of the author of your own actions if you have low testosterone. Yeah. But yeah, it's linked to like obesity, diabetes and various, it is kind of an all round health marker. But it governs behavior in interesting ways.
So just a quick thing, doesn't it also have something to do with bone density?
Low testosterone, like,
Because I remember reading a thing about eunuchs in ancient Assyria and how they have strange skeletal problems.
They do, You can identify castrati and eunuchs just from their skeletons.
Yes. And so it's like, okay, well, if we have a civilization that is essentially manufacturing eunuchs organically now, then, you know, we are entering into a world where men in particular, and, you know, not women having these problems, will have a series of health conditions that we're inflicting upon them.
Absolutely. It is true. Yeah. I mean, and I talk about the history of endocrinology, you know, the history of hormonal interventions and study of hormones. And it's like, we've actually been making hormonal interventions for a long time. You know, the first castration was man's first, whether it was a bull or a slave.
Yeah.
You know, that was like a kind of like a defining moment in human history. That was the first crude intervention to modify hormones to you know, drive behavioral changes and domesticate other humans or animals. I think that we're not led to appreciate just how important testosterone is for various different reasons that we could speculate about whatever, but it's crucial. It is crucial to male health, and the fact that it's not taken seriously, I think, is a function of the fact that actually men aren't taken seriously, and male, you know, I mean, like I'm not one of these guys who's these sort of mental health guys, you know, it's like, oh, you know, men are suffering a mental health crisis. Yeah. And
I don't want to stigmatize those guys either. No. Because a lot of men are suffering a mental health crisis.
But male issues that specifically affect men aren't taken seriously because men are in many respects second class citizens.
But the problem with this is the framing kind of implies that the feminist system needs to take care of its pet men.
Yes, and this is
that's the problem with it.
Well, that's something that I kind of hit out at in the book. I mean, because the book is like an intervention in the kind of crisis of masculinity literature. Mm. So, you know, like Jordan Peterson, for example. I mean, he's made a name for himself as a kind of surrogate father figure to all of these aimless young men who are drifting and just, you know, like wasting their lives, not growing up. But then you have all these people like Richard Reeves. I think he wrote a book called Boys and Men, and Josh Hawley, Senator Josh Hawley, wrote a kind of much more Christian tinged book about masculinity. And a lot of the time, Richard Reeves' book especially, then the argument is, you know, like, we need to be nicer to men. That's what we need. We need to be nicer to them. Like, we've forgotten that actually there are good things about men and we need to be nice to them. And the framing of the whole problem is fundamentally within the boundaries of this kind of sort of feminine ethic of care. You know? Yeah. It's like we've just stopped caring about men. We need to tell them they're good. You know, you need to give men a pat on the back from time to time and let them feel like you still know they're there and, you know, you like them and they're not monsters. And it's like, no, you actually need to let men be men on their own terms. And that's a very complicated thing, of course, because the whole system is geared against
that. They essentially need to be
that.
Unleashed.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. It's not like, you know, it's a dog. They're dogs who just need a treat.
Yeah.
It's like, no. I mean, it's like...
The entire mechanism of the civilization is destructive to the kind of spirit of manhood.
Mm.
And this is something that is just... I mean, what is being asked for is too difficult to ask to walk back.
Yes.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
And so we are kind of trapped in this downward spiral where eventually half of the human race is just going to find itself with debilitating kind of intrinsic diseases and won't be able to fulfill the actual functions that are required of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the outlook is very bleak.
Yeah.
And I end the book, I won't spoil the ending, but I end the book with a very open question about the nature of liberal democracy and whether it could, even if you solved the biological problems, even if you got the harmful chemicals out of the food and the water, even if you got men exercising and, you know, doing weights and looking after themselves, like within the parameters of a liberal democratic society, like how much can men be men?
Mm.
Is this kind of an inextricable problem from the nature of the system itself? And I mean, that's a difficult question.
And I don't think it's just liberal democracy either. No. I think it's modernity.
Yes.
The very nature of the scientific technological system.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that life in communist China is much better.
Yes.
Or that life in the communist Soviet Union was better, although what you did have was you had... at the very least, the sense of being part of a grand struggle, a grand struggle over history and the future of mankind, which might have kind of mitigated in certain respects. But, you know,
and vice versa. I could imagine some kind of democratic mechanisms in a hunter-gatherer society would work fine.
Right? Yeah.
You know, I could see that being a way that a tribe would resolve conflicts without violence, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not that it intrinsically is a bad thing, but I genuinely think it's the industrial system we live in that is inescapable and destroying us.
Yeah, well, I mean, I do think it robs man of agency in certain respects. I think it cheapens his kind of like views and values, and it makes things seem worthless and pointless.
And also irrational.
Difficult to undo.
Right. The very desire to not have the biological and spiritual inheritance of being a man stripped away from you without any recourse. The only alternative will seem utterly irrational to anyone who hasn't started thinking about this in any substantially. Yeah. What you, are you suggesting we smash the system that's provided you with everything? It's like,
kind of. Well, you go and live in the woods like Ted Kaczynski.
Yeah, exactly. That seems ridiculous.
Yeah. But then, of course, the problem for Ted Kaczynski was the modern world caught up.
Wouldn't let him. Yeah. I mean, he probably shouldn't have sent so many mail bombs.
No.
Maybe he would have gotten away with it if he hadn't done that. But that's the point. Like, the person who does this sort of thing, who tries to venture outside of this box, just seems like a madman, because nobody would understand why you would willingly give up the things that it took so long to build.
Yeah.
So I mean, what's your suggestion?
I genuinely don't know. I mean, I do, in my more pessimistic moments, and I do definitely agree with someone like Max Weber that modernity is an iron prison, an iron cage. Well, iron prison actually is the term that the Bronze Age pervert used, but it's the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like our ancestors, what is it that Weber says? He says something like the Calvinist wanted to work within a calling, we're forced to. We're forced to work within the Calvinist's calling, but stripped of all of its kind of spiritual aspects, and it's just a self-fulfilling kind of rationality that drives us just to, you know, to make more and more money and rationalize the world. I really don't know. And I think that what's interesting about Fukuyama is obviously, and his analysis is obviously, that he leaves this large irrational element in the center of it. He's like, look, I can't say any more than this. Like, I think,
well, he just seems hopeful to me. He's like, I just hope that we can sublimate it into the rest of it. And it's like, yeah, okay, but that's from what you've laid out. I'm more inclined to think wars of the spirit are coming.
Yeah.
You know,
well, I kind of end the book in the epilogue, and I talk about this essay that was written by William James in 1910 called The Moral Equivalent of War. So William James, philosopher, Varieties of Religious Experience. He was the brother of Henry James, the novelist, American. And he was a socialist. He was a big-time socialist, believer in progress and you know. But he says in this reasonably short essay, you know, like, I am a pacifist and I don't believe in war and I believe in progress and I material advancement and that kind of stuff. But you'd have to be a fool not to see that actually war is, in many respects, the mother of all virtue. War has inculcated in man some of his very best aspects. Selfless heroism, the ability to courage, the ability to subordinate oneself to a greater purpose, to serve others, you know, to give your life in service of a cause. And these are virtues that have made us great. They've created great civilizations. They've also created great destruction. And now in the modern age, they could totally destroy us. Advanced industrial societies going to war, you know, could lead to the destruction of the planet and all life on it. But we still need courage and self-sacrifice and subordination and all these kind of stuff and ability to work within a hierarchy, blah, blah, blah. So how do we preserve those things if we're going to move away from war, if we're going to stop killing each other on the battlefield, but we still want those things, where do we get them from? And he comes up with this idea that we need a moral equivalent for war within society. And his harebrained idea, kind of harebrained idea, is that we need to wage a war on nature.
Oh, God.
Which is not in the sense of like...
Well, mission accomplished. Look at where we are now.
Not in the sense of like nuking nature, but in the sense that what we need to do is we need to kind of devote our energy and our efforts towards improving the material world and towards, you know, so he says things like, you know, we should send young men out to build railroads and skyscrapers and... you know, so that they can be part of this kind of colossal effort to transform nature and improve human society. I mean, it's a pretty socialistic view, actually, in many respects.
Very Fourieristic with his phalansterism.
Yeah, kind of stuff. Yeah. But it's it at least is a serious attempt to grapple with the problem that actually, like, when you need a surrogate, if you're going to eliminate these kind of fundamental aspects of man's history and nature and kind of activities that he's always taken part in that have kind of consecrated his life, if you will, his existence, then you need some kind of surrogate for them. But the question, of course, is whether a surrogate can ever be as satisfying as the real thing. And that's something that, Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, says no. It's like, all we do now is we, and someone like David Graeber, you know, with bullshit jobs, you know, it's like we're, this is a surrogate for real meaning. Only the real thing will do. And I mean, I don't know. I genuinely don't know if you can. My suspicion is that no, surrogate activities will never, satisfy man enough.
And moreover, even if you do find them satisfying, I have a feeling that the surrogate activity, because it's contained within the box of modernity, won't actually do what you wanted it to do anyway.
No.
It will feel as if you're nearly doing it, but it will never have the proper effect anyway.
Yeah.
So it will just be wasted energy at the very best.
Yeah.
And so, this is the reason I asked you to come and have this conversation, basically, is because this has been something that's been playing on my mind for a long time, that we may well actually have no easy way out of all of this. And we're actually creating a terrible prison for ourselves.
Yeah.
Which is terribly depressing and a note to end on. But anyway, Charles, thank you so much for coming.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm so glad other people are thinking in this way because I try not to think about it too much because the more you read and the more you think, oh God.
Yeah.
You know, this is, and this, it's a problem with such a big scope as well. But I think it is one we have to grapple with.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So anyway, thanks so much for coming in.
It was my pleasure.